Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we'll have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send us an email, we're at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. If you'd like to look at the website, it's at www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the last five, the most recent ones, are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Now let's get started. You know, this time we're going to talk about confidence and how we can instill confidence in the group that we're going to reach the goal and how we can keep our own confidence that we're going to succeed, that we're going to make it, that we're going to go forward. And I think that the first thing we're going to ask is, what is confidence? What does it mean to have confidence that you're going to succeed, that we're going to reach the goal as a group, and we're going to learn something together? And, oh, I see I have lots of participation. Thank you for all of your participation. Let's see. Quite a few people are saying that confidence is the same thing as self-assurance. You know what? I think that that's a fair statement, because if you have confidence in yourself, you're self-assured, right? You are a person that thinks that they're going to succeed, that we're going to go forward, and has an idea of how to do it. Self-assurance. And Sahita and others are saying that confidence is really conviction to the goal. Conviction to the goal, that we have conviction, we have confidence that we're going to go forward and we're not going to quit, right? This conviction that we're right and we need to and we're going to find a way, right? That's confidence and self-assurance and conviction. That's a good point, Sahita and others, that conviction. I'm getting a lot of agreement on that, and thank you for all of your participation. You know, Donald says it's a strong belief in the value of attempting to reach the goals. A strong belief in the value of attempting to reach the goals. Yeah, I suppose that's true. People agree that nothing's certain. I mean, you can't guarantee, I suppose, that you're going to succeed. Although, quite frankly, if we have conviction and confidence and self-assurance, unless something changes on the outside, like the law changes, or something that we can't control changes on us, usually, I can say pretty much always, we manage to reach the goal. We manage to succeed. Sometimes, of course, and yes, a lot of people are mentioning this. Thank you for all of your participation. Sometimes it's true that the original goal that we set, what we thought we were going to accomplish, has to be modified a little bit, right? Well, that happens sometimes. Sometimes we have to say, well, we are almost there, and we're going to proceed on these circumstances. But yeah, we can make it. Strong belief in the value of attempting to reach the goals. Good point. You know, Fallon and others are pointing out there's not only a strong belief, or that you're going to, and a conviction on the part of the participants of the group, but oftentimes it's a need for the desired change creates confidence in your abilities to change it. Interesting point, Fallon. The need for the desired change creates confidence in the ability to change it. You got to do it. You need to. It's not a matter of preference. It's something that really, really needs to be done. And if you've got the conviction, as Sahita says, and Donald, the strong belief, and we have a lot of agreement, and thank you for all of your participation, and then you really have the need to change it. People are asking what kind of a need. Well, this good point. Fallon says a need to change a social injustice. And a lot of people are pointing out kind of practical needs, like an economic need. Something needs to change. Good point. I'm getting a lot of people who are saying that it's not only something needs to change, but sometimes there's a proposal to change something, and it needs to stay the same. Yeah, that's a really valid point. Sometimes it's not that we're fighting to change something. We're fighting to keep something, isn't it? And that's our goal, that the law doesn't change, that circumstances don't change, that for something that we can control doesn't become different because we find it desirable. And sometimes we need to negotiate with the people who wish to make the change so we can reach a compromise, don't we? And that's confidence, too. We have to have the confidence, right, to go forward. Yes, you know, this is a very good point that a lot of people are making. And it's the confidence to come forward. Yeah, the confidence to say, you know, this needs to be done. I'm going to step up and do it. Somebody has to come forward. Someone has to volunteer. Someone has to say this is wrong or this is right and shouldn't be changed. I'm going to do it. I'm going to come forward. I have the confidence, the conviction, and the strong belief, right, to say, me, I'm going to volunteer. I'm going to campaign. I'm going to do whatever needs to be done. I'm going to be the person that steps forward. And I'm going to join with others who will also step forward. You see, sometimes it's hard. And it's at least time-consuming to step forward and try to effectuate a change, to stop something that's wrong or stop something that's going to be. Whatever it is that we're trying to do, you know, people, this is a very good point, that it doesn't have to be a social change, right? See, we're speaking as though we're going to change something that's social, that's a law. It can be a change within your, or a issue, we'll call it an issue, an issue within your workplace. Right. And sometimes that's the hardest to step forward on, right? Because you don't want to lose your job. Right. You don't want to be, that's a very good point. A lot of people are saying that they've wanted to step forward and have the confidence to take a stand when it could be economically disastrous. It could be a really bad thing if it doesn't work. So you have to have the confidence that it will, that the goal will be achieved, that you can step forward, right? And yes, so the workplace is the perfect point. I'm getting a lot of agreement and a lot of people telling me stories. Thank you very much for that. It was hard to step forward in a place where they needed to make their living, where they couldn't afford to lose their job, right? And a lot of people are making, you know, Carol and others are saying, well, it was a matter of unfairness because, for example, women were not being promoted, right? And they were just disqualified and they got the certification or whatever was needed, but they weren't being promoted. And they were being discriminated against. And it's hard to be the person that steps forward and forms the group, right? Yeah, good point. You know, Diane and others are pointing out that sometimes when you step forward and you say this needs to change or we want this to happen, a lot of people are talking about unions and other things, and when you step forward and you're the first, it's especially hard, and you have to have an especially high confidence that you are right and you have conviction of your goal and a strong belief and a need for the desired change, just like Sahita and Donald and Fallon and others have said. And it's hard to be the first because you're not certain that others will follow, right? You know, stories about people who are leaders and us, really, we're leaders and hosts and like that. We like to tell the stories where we got a following, where others followed us and it was successful and like that. But we've all got a story where we stood up and said, let's do this, and, well, nobody showed up. Yeah, it's hard to be the first one. You got to have confidence and self-assurance. You know, a lot of people are using the word boldness, to be bold, to be not only confident, but to be extra confident and bold, have boldness so that you are the first, so that you can lead. Because, of course, a lot of people might like be willing to step forward, but they need someone to start, right? And a lot of times, we are the person that starts. You know, a lot of times I'm the seminar and workshop leader. It doesn't even have to be an issue, a problem of any sort. You know, a lot of times we do seminars and workshops about, for example, compliance. Compliance with the laws in the United States, and I know this is a global show, but it's true in a lot of countries that there are regulations and laws about human behavior in the workplace, right? And we have to learn what the requirements are and how to comply. And if somebody accidentally, so to speak, but, you know, if human nature takes over and there is, well, a breach of compliance, what to do about it and how to handle the aggrieved party and the other party so that it doesn't get out of hand, right? And so that there has to be a procedure. You have to know what to do. And so a lot of times I teach those kinds of classes and seminars and workshops, and it takes confidence to be the leader even when there's no issue, no problem, the goal is knowledge and the goal is to learn what to do if it ever happens in the future, and the goal is to learn not to do the bad things so that you don't have the problem, right? But there's not a present issue. It's kind of a knowledge goal for the future, right? But you still need someone to lead that, and you still need people to come. Well, that's a good point. People are saying that those kind of groups are mandatory. This is true. They are mandatory by law so that people know what to do, but to have people participate is a matter of confidence. Mm-hmm. Ooh, this is an interesting point. Some of our friends, especially in the military, thank you for all of your participation, are mentioning that if you're going to be the leader, people have to have confidence that what you say in the group will be kept confidential, will be kept private, will not be reported to the employer, for example. That it is a safe place, sometimes we call that, that you can speak out, that you can have a frank discussion, an honest discussion, and that nobody's a spy, so to speak. You have to have confidence in your fellow participants. What an interesting point. I actually didn't think about it that way. You know, I always say I learned something during these shows, and I hope you do too. I didn't think of it in that direction, but of course that's true. When we hold any kind of a group that is related to each other, not family, but related in they're in the same organization, they're in the same workplace, or it's really a fact-finding or a think tank type group, what is said in the room remains confidential, right? You don't report it to anybody because you're forming a plan. Yeah. You're forming a goal. You need to be able to speak openly and not be afraid. You have to have confidence in the discretion of your fellow participant. Good point. Thank you. I never even thought about it in that angle. But of course that's true. That's one of the things you have to have confidence in, isn't it? Not just yourself, but in the others. Good point. Thank you. Yeah. And Abraham and others are also saying that you have to have confidence that the outcome will improve the circumstances. You have to have confidence you're doing the right thing, right? Yeah, you have to have confidence that the outcome will improve the circumstances. Yes. You know, this is a good point. People are saying that it's hard to know what the actual outcome will be because there's always, there's an expression, the law of unintended consequences. It's kind of like, well, this is what we think needs to be done. And when it actually is put into place and you reach the goal, this happens a lot. A lot of you know that I happen to be an attorney. This happens a lot when laws are written. It seems really straightforward. And a law was written for a specific purpose to solve something, right? And you know they're all written by committee and by legislatures and stuff, which is like getting it written by committee. But a single person doesn't do it, really. And everybody looks at it and they go, yeah, that seems right to me. That seems like it's going to accomplish our goal. And then when it goes into practice, yeah, strange things happen. Stephen says strange things happen. Yes, that's exactly. You have the law of unintended consequences. Sometimes it's used differently and in a different way than any of the creators thought it would be. But you do have to have some confidence that what you're doing, the outcome will improve the circumstances. And if it doesn't work out properly, you have to have confidence that you can fix it. Yeah. You go back and go, oh, my, that's not what we intended. Let's revise that. Let's fix it. Yeah. Sometimes that happens. It's happened to me several times. Janice and others are also saying that you have to have the confidence that you can work together to achieve a goal. Yeah. You not only have to have confidence in your fellow participants, that they will have some discretion if you speak openly, but you have to have confidence that you can work together, right? And we're going to talk about the recipe for peace now, idea of a convivial atmosphere and getting to know each other, because that's something that will boost the confidence level, confidence that you can work together to achieve the goal. Yeah, people are saying sometimes it's not even confidence. You just have to work together to achieve the goal. Yep, that's true too, and that's confidence that you can do it, that you can get the goal done. Now we've talked about working together and like that and what is confidence, but I think the next question is going to be, and the question that's being asked, and you know that these shows are not scripted. They're kind of organic. They come from the questions that are being asked. And thank you for all of your participation. People are asking how we personally create confidence to create or join a group. How do we personally get the confidence to do this, to create the group? And how do we get the confidence to join a group? See, these are all things that take an active participation. We have to do something. We have to have the confidence and the self-assurance and boldness to say, yeah, we're going to start a group. Or, yeah, I'm going to join that group. That looks like that's something I want to do. And let's see. This is a good point. Vanessa and others are saying that what you do when you have the confidence to create or join a group is that you do it by having strong feelings about the group goal. You know, that's a real, you know, real good point. And a lot of people are agreeing and saying about the same thing. Thank you, Vanessa and others, that you need to, that you have strong feelings about the group goal, and therefore you do it. You join it. You look for it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an interesting point that several people are making. Stephen says that sometimes you join or create a group because you want to have self-improvement. See, I didn't think about that as a purpose either, but it sure is true that you want to have self-improvement. You join the group to learn from others. That's a very good point. Yeah, I'm getting a lot of agreement. Sometimes you create or join a group so that you can have self-improvement and learn from others. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, this is a good point, too. Misha says that it takes confidence not only to join a group to learn from others, but you need confidence to teach the group about your life experience. You are the master, the teacher that others are learning from. You need confidence to teach the group about your life experiences. You have something to offer. Good point, Misha and others. Getting a lot of agreement. Thank you for all of your participation. You would like to teach the group about your life experiences. You've got something to offer that they can learn. Wow. Mm-hmm. Brian says that you're confident that you can share knowledge with the group and influence the outcome. You have confidence that you can share knowledge with the group and influence the outcome. There's a group and they have a good goal, but you think that they need to have some more experience. Someone needs to tell them something and you're it. Mm-hmm. Share knowledge with the group and influence the outcome. Because when you come with your knowledge and your experience, it will naturally influence the outcome, won't it? Yeah, because you'll say, well, you know, you're not thinking about this particular aspect of it. This is what we did, and it was successful. Good point. I'm getting quite a bit of feedback. Thank you very much for all of your participation. That sometimes you go to the group as a member of the group or the leader. You can use your life experience and say, this is what we did wrong. Let's not repeat it. Good point. You can learn from mistakes, right, as well as from positive life experiences. We succeeded in a similar area. You can learn from mistakes. Uh-oh, this didn't work. And it looks like we're going to repeat it again, and it didn't work then, and there's no reason to think it'll work now. Let's think of something different. Mm-hmm. Share knowledge with the group and influence the outcome. Yeah, knowledge goes both ways. Mm-hmm. Caroline says you can use your expertise and professional learning to help the group because it's what the group needs. Confidence in your contribution ability. You're confident because you have expertise and professional learning that the group needs. Have confidence in your contribution. That's a very good point, too, that you have real professional skills that the group would have to hire somebody to do, and that you can make a contribution of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've done that for a group that needs real help, and it's just otherwise they're in trouble. Yeah, the confidence in your contribution. Mm-hmm. So, now we've talked about our confidence and our confidence and what is confidence. And the question is being asked, and it's a very good one, and probably the next one up. How do we create and maintain group confidence? We're starting out, right? We've gotten all excited and enthusiastic, and the goal is good. And we volunteered, we've stepped forward. Yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes, well, okay, but people are saying that you don't necessarily have to volunteer. You could actually be paid. This is true, especially if you have expertise. I mean, I get paid when I do a workshop or a seminar, or I bring my expertise to a group. Not all groups, but you need to step forward and say, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't necessarily mean in the actual literal sense of not being paid, because hey, your time has monetary value, doesn't it? Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. So how do we create and maintain group confidence? How do we keep it going? We've gotten excited and we've joined because we're enthusiastic. But how do we maintain it? How do we keep it going? Because sometimes the process takes quite a while, and it's unavoidable. You can't solve something, or you can't resolve issues, or you can't even learn something in a very short period of time. It takes some practice. It takes some repetition. It takes some, well, it takes some time and effort, let's face it. So how do we maintain group confidence? Mm-hmm. You know, Ray has a very good point, and we've said it before, and several other people too. Thank you for all of your participation. Ray says you maintain group confidence by remembering to celebrate every small victory. By remembering to celebrate every small victory. What a fantastic idea, and we do that. When I'm the leader, we celebrate each time we succeed, when we take another step forward, because it's a real good way to keep momentum, to maintain confidence that you're going to reach the goal. Because sometimes it seems like, oh, we're not getting very far very fast. Oh, man, this is hard. I'm too busy. I'm going to wander off. But if we celebrate every victory and every success and every time we move forward, then we can see as a group that we're getting there, that we're heading down the path. It may be kind of a far journey, but we're working on it, and it's succeeding. We have confidence that we should still work and go forward. Mm-hmm. Confidence by remembering to celebrate every small victory. Yes. You know, Lisa and others are making a very good point, too, that not only do you celebrate every small victory and every step and keep the momentum, but Lisa says you keep the meeting time to a minimum and only meet when something is happening. Confidence can become tired during the process. It will feel that you'll never get to the goal. Wow, that's so true. Keep the meeting time to a minimum and only meet when something is happening. Yeah, you know, I never like to meet for the sake of meeting. We need to have an agenda. We need to be doing something, right? Confidence can become tired during the process. Yeah, it's not that people really give up exactly, right? But we've all been in groups, all been in some sort of an organization that doesn't ever seem to get anywhere. Ooh, people are saying workplace committees. Yeah, that too. But you know how you don't seem to be, you've got a goal, you've got issues that need to be resolved, but you don't seem to, every meeting's kind of the same, and when you walk out, you go, ah, gee, we didn't get no place, right? Confidence can become tired during the process. That's why you need a good leader, which is us, right? You need to know that when you walk out of the meeting, that something has been accomplished, mm-hmm. That we've gone forward, that we've gotten a new idea, that we've gotten something to look for, to do, to report back even, right? Confidence can become tired during the process. That's because the process has lost momentum. Got to keep pushing forward. Got to keep doing something. Not for the sake of doing something, right, but to progress. Mm-hmm. Or you feel that you will never get to the goal. See, that causes lack of confidence in the group. You lose momentum. You haven't maintained it, right? Yeah. Quinn says you need to keep a high enthusiasm level. That's true especially of the leader or whoever it is, not the leader, and also the person that is organizing it, right? Now, I tend, of course, and all of us tend to be, because that's why we're participating in this program, all of us tend to be the leader or at least a very active participant in whatever we're doing. But also, you know, there's such a thing as delegating some of the duties. I do it all the time because there's a limit to how much actual hours a day you can put into something because you've got a lot of somethings, right? So that's why you have wonderful staff and assistants or volunteer who volunteers to keep the thing organized and keep the momentum going. It's very important to keep contact, right? And to tell what progress is being made and to do scheduling. And these are not minor jobs. They're very, very important to keep the enthusiasm and the interest high, which will keep confidence high that we're going to succeed, right? You know, George says you need to give everyone a job that they are able to succeed at. Wonderful idea. And that's where the organization person is. Oftentimes, they're a volunteer who is very well, very adept at keeping things going. Mm-hmm. And there's other jobs, right? We've talked in the past, and if you want to hear prior shows, the last five are archived at the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of them are archived at the radio station, blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. And we've talked about the use of, for lack of a better word, like subcommittees, assigning research projects, assigning what people to find out. You know, the internet's a wonderful thing. What people in this circumstance in the past did. Did they succeed? Well, maybe we can take some hints. Did they not succeed? Well, we can take some hints from that too and try not to emulate that. But as George says, and a lot of people are agreeing, you give everyone a job that they are able to succeed at. Oh, we're going to celebrate a victory. We've succeeded. We've done something proactive. Our enthusiasm is still high in our confidence. You know, Opal and others are making a very good point that I always do, and you should too. And I do it because, well, I'm polite, but I do it because over experience, I know how much it means to people. Opal says that you must remember to thank and to praise participation. Mm-hmm. For example, throughout the show, I say thank you for all of your participation, and I mean it. I love hearing from you, and it's wonderful that you're there and you're listening and you're thinking with me. Mm-hmm. And you're guiding the show because it's not pre-written. Remember to thank and to praise participation. Mm-hmm. I think a handwritten note is always lovely. People really appreciate it. An email sent to everybody thanking someone for their extra effort, for their opinion, for coming, for whatever it is. Thank people. And I'm not a big fan of thanking in private. I think you should thank people in front of everybody. You should thank them in emails that are reply all, because then everybody understands that their participation is noted, that it is a good thing, and they will be praised when they do something good, when they really participate, when they contribute. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Michael and others are saying that's the ticket. You include everyone in participation. If all the individuals are confident of success, then the group is confident of success. Yeah. Everybody participates. Everybody has a job that they can succeed at, as George says. Everybody gets thanked and praised. they're all the individuals are confident that we're going to make it. Well, that's who the group is, right? The group is the individuals. Mm-hmm. And Tina says you need to remember to break the process into steps so that you can build momentum and confidence. Yeah. We've talked about that too, right? Sometimes the goal seems very far away because the issues are kind of complicated. And it's like, oh, gee, that's some goal you got there. So you break it down into steps, and you work your way to the first step, and then you achieve that, and then you go forward. You kind of break the process down into the various issues. Mm-hmm. And it makes it more manageable. And sometimes it'll take a long time, but it's still, you still gain momentum. You still got the momentum going. Richard and others are saying you need a positive attitude that assumes success. Yeah, we're going to assume that we're going to make it because, well, we've talked about self-fulfilling prophecies, haven't we, in the past? We're going to have a positive attitude that assumes success. That's our confidence level. That's our momentum. Yeah, we can do it. Helen and others are saying that you encourage networking. Yeah, we certainly do at Recipe for Peace now, don't we? And, yeah, it's true, too. People are saying that you need to have confidence not only in the participants, confidence in yourself, that you're going to get the momentum, but you also need confidence in the leader that they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think a good leader does indeed depend on the participants. I like to hear everybody's opinion. I like to know what everyone, because quite frankly, I'm not certain that I know exactly where to lead when I'm a leader, right? I need help. I need everybody to participate and have confidence that together we will succeed. Mm-hmm. And Nicole says you need confidence in the process by encouraging participation in networking and goal orientation. Mm-hmm. Confidence in the process that you need to encourage participant networking and goal orientation. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that we're getting now towards networking and to the thought that you share your experiences. And, yes, people are going, oh, we're going to talk about food. Yes, we are. And that's one of the reasons, in fact, that is the reason, that Recipe for Peace Now says, you know, you create a convivial atmosphere. It'll keep the momentum going also, partially because it's so much fun to go to one of the groups, one of the meetings, one of the workshops, one of the seminars. We have fun. It's not, and it may be a serious issue at hand, but we get along. It's pleasant. It's convivial. And when we have food, and we often do, it's not really because we are hungry. And I know those of you who have been here before, and thank you for all of your participation. I know I say this each time, but it's true. We don't have the food necessarily because we are hungry. The food is a tool to get us to have a convivial atmosphere and to have something to do when we need to have a break, when we need to have a time out, when we need to say, wait a minute, let's all step back and think about this. Mm-hmm. It's a tool. It's something to do together. Mm-hmm. And I'm about to say this thing that I always say, and I can prove it. If you would like to listen to prior episodes, I know a lot of you have returned, and I have a lot of new people too. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for coming. When you're going to have food, this is a very important thing to say. You need to communicate to everybody, whether anybody has an allergy, food allergy, a food sensitivity, or prohibition, or a religious prohibition to some sort of food, right? You need to find out because you don't want anybody to have a bad time. It's a convivial atmosphere. It's a way to get together and to talk to each other outside of the formal circle, outside of the formal negotiation process, right? It's a way to, well, it's a way to communicate, and also a way for the leader to get a time out to say, to go around and make nice and to smooth over anything that, well, might be getting in the way of a good negotiated settlement. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have some food, and you know that I always say this also, but it's very important not only to label the food. Yes, we're going to ask, we're going to make a survey and find out if anybody has a food allergy, a dietary prohibition, or a religious prohibition. And when anyone brings food or has food come, you need to label the food. Not what is it, meatloaf, no. You need to say what's in it so that people can make a judgment as to whether or not they can eat it. Yes. And also, those of you who have been here before, thank you for coming back. I see there's lots of you. And for the new people, welcome, welcome, welcome. And the, you know that I think that as host, and we usually are, it's our responsibility to have some extra food. I don't like to run out. It makes for a bad party. And I think you should have a safe recipe in addition to a more adventurous one. Now, what's a safe recipe? Well, it's a recipe that doesn't have too many ingredients. And after I've taken my survey, I know that my people are probably not unable to eat them, the ingredients that's in the safe recipe. And it's got ingredients that my participants would be familiar with. Now, I happen to live in the United States, and my familiarity with certain types of food is different than yours, maybe. So you have to think about what your people will have eaten before and be familiar with. Now, today, we're going to have a safe recipe that's a horseradish meatloaf. A listener sent this in. It is absolutely delicious, and I have been accused of not having too much seasoning in my food, quite frankly, because I put it on the side. I think people like to choose. So I usually make an error on the point on the side of blandness rather than spiciness. But this is absolutely delicious. I was thinking that it might not be a safe recipe because it does have horseradish. And horseradish is kind of unusual, and it doesn't show. It's mixed in, so it must be very carefully labeled in red that there's horseradish in it. I called it horseradish meatloaf. And y'all see this. Jenna says that she is actually allergic to horseradish. It makes her lips swell. See, I didn't even know you could be allergic to horseradish. But yes, so you must label this very carefully so that people know it's in there. And I think in my area people will have eaten horseradish, but if you think that it might be a question about it, do take it out. It's a perfectly good recipe without it. So here we go. It's just a basic meatloaf recipe. I've added a little bit of horseradish. Now I'm scared, and I think you might take it out if you want a safe recipe out of it. So we're going to make it big. We can divide it into two loaf pans because it depends how big your pan is, right? But we're going to use 3 pounds of ground beef. I personally like to use beef with a little bit of fat running through it because I think it's more tasty, but you can choose how you think about that. 3 eggs, nice large eggs, 1 cup of breadcrumbs. You'll look at the consistency and see if you need a little bit more than a cup. I'm afraid that I use commercial breadcrumbs. You can use day-old bread and make it dry and make crumbs out of it. If you use the commercial breadcrumbs, I kind of like the ones with a little bit of flavoring. I like the Italian breadcrumbs. I think that it adds a little bit of flavor. You must, of course, label that. We're going to have an onion that we're going to finely chop, really finely. I know I'm going to use 1/2 cup of ketchup. You want to be finer than I am, you can use something the equivalent that is homemade. But I'm just going to use regular old ketchup because it's easy for me to get. And I'm going to put 2 tablespoons of white horseradish in here. Did we just have the speech about how that might make it less safe and you need to carefully label it? Yes, you all heard that. Okay, It's just that I promised horseradish meatloaf. And it's just yummy, but you got to think about it. So we're going to preheat our oven to 400, and we're going to take the meat, the eggs, the breadcrumbs, the onion, the ketchup, the horseradish, and we're going to squish them all together. We are. I usually put the wet things in first. I put the eggs in first, and I put the ketchup in first into the meat and the horseradish. I mix it all up, and then I put the breadcrumbs in and the onions, because you can judge the consistency and whether you need more breadcrumbs after it's all mixed. I put the breadcrumbs in first. I put the onions in last because they're little denser pieces. All mixed up, all lovely. I usually spray the loaf pans just because. You'll decide if you need to, depending on how much fat you've got in your meat. And you press it all nice and firmly in. This is really, we've got 3 pounds of meat and a cup of crumbs. This is really 2 loaf pans worth. It's 2 meatloafs worth. I don't, depending on how big your group is, you can decide. You spoon it in, you press it all down nice and firm. And you bake it until it's all nice and done. I think it takes about an hour, give or take. You know that you kind of put a toothpick in and see if it comes out red. About an hour will do it. You want to be perfectly safe, maybe an hour and 15 minutes. You don't want to burn it. And you take the meatloaf out. It is delicious. It is wonderful. The way to get meatloaf out of the pan in one piece, in my experience, has been to let it stand for about 10 minutes. Because it kind of settles in, and then you can get it out more neatly, and it won't come apart on you. So, that's it. It's the easiest thing in the world. You take those ingredients, you label the horseradish really carefully, and the ketchup. Yes, people are telling me they have tomato allergies. Good point. You label everything really carefully when you serve it, but you just mix it all together. You squish it into the pan really nice and tight, pop it in the oven. Oh, delicious. And everybody likes it. And I usually pre-slice it because people make a mess when they slice. But that's just me, and you can decide on your group. So, and to get it out of the pan properly, let it stand for 10 minutes. So that's our safe recipe. It needs to be labeled carefully because it's not quite as safe as my usual safe. But it is a delicious and rather traditional meatloaf. And surprisingly enough, the horseradish is yummy in it. Okay, so a listener sent that in, and thank you very, very much. Okay, now we're going to have our adventure recipe. Why is it an adventure recipe? Well, because there's a good chance that people will not be eating pork. It's pork, right? And there is a lot of religious prohibitions against pork, and some people just don't eat pork. So it's got pork in it. And people are already asking if you can substitute beef. I don't see why not. Quite frankly, I would substitute chicken because beef's a little bit tougher than pork, generally speaking, but chicken is not. And yes, you could substitute chicken. It would make it a safer recipe. And you can decide. You can decide on how, what kind of participants you've got. But here we go. We're going to call this sweet and sour pork. It's kind of a traditional one with pineapple in it. So we're going to have a couple tablespoons of vegetable oil. We're going to have 2.5 pounds of pork, 3 pounds, depending on how many and how much meat you want, how much pork you want in it. And we're going to get the nice like pork tenderloin and cut it into cubes. We're going to have 2 cans, they're about, 10-ounce cans, of pineapple pieces. Because there's no sense in buying the whole pineapple rings, because we're only going to cut them into pieces, so you might as well buy the cheaper one. And we are not going to drain it, because we're going to use the pineapple juice, which is kind of delicious, which means in the United States, yes, if you have fresh pineapple, yours will be better than mine. And you could just bring some pineapple juice, which comes in little cans. But I use canned pineapple. It is easy and for me to get and inexpensive. So you have to decide what you want to use. Yeah, it doesn't bother me to use canned pineapple, but you could do as you please. And yes, yours will be more yummy than mine. So we've got two cans, like 9-ounce, 10-ounce cans of pineapple pieces that are undrained. Personally speaking, I think you should get the kind that is in natural juice and not the kind with that thick sugar to juice on it, if you can possibly do so. A nice green pepper, nice regular green pepper that we're going to devein and seed and cut into chunks. We're going to do the same thing with a red pepper. We're going to devein it and seed it and cut it into chunks. A tablespoon of cornstarch because we're going to want to kind of thicken the whole thing. And about a half cup of sweet and sour sauce. It comes in a jar around here. And there's undoubtedly an entire recipe to make sweet and sour sauce. And I'm certain that that would be lovely, too. I'm going to use the jar because, well, you only have so much time to make this, right? And it's delicious, and I don't know how to make sweet and sour sauce. But you can if you'd like. So I'm going to use a jar, a half cup of bought sweet and sour sauce. So we're going to get ourselves a large skillet, and we're going to put the oil in it and heat it up. We're going to add the chunks of pork, and we're going to stir fry them. Yay! What, it'll take about 3-4 minutes until it's no longer pink and it's brown on all sides, right? And you might have to use two batches in order to do this. Take them out, stir fry it, take them out. So we're going to throw all the pork back in if we had to use two batches. We're going to drain the pineapple, but we're not going to throw out the juice. So we're going to add the pineapple. Well, let's add the peppers first. Let's add the peppers to the skillet and make sure that they're nice and stir-fried. It takes, about 2 minutes or so because we've made them into little chunks. And now we're going to add the pineapple because the pineapple is softer and it is pre-cooked, essentially speaking, right? We've used canned. But that's the drained canned, right? And so we're going to stir-fry the whole thing again for another 2 minutes. Now we're going to add the pineapple juice and, the cornstarch. Well, let's put the cornstarch in the pineapple juice first. Stir it all around. Otherwise, the cornstarch is liable to lump. So we've made the cornstarch and the pineapple juice combined to make it all smooth. We're going to add it to the skillet along with the sweet and sour sauce. Mm-hmm. Cook the whole thing. Make it all hot. Make it all delicious. Stir it until it is a little bit thickened. It won't take very long. It's, a few minutes. The whole thing is already hot, and it's all cooked. And you want to be sure that the pork is cooked through. That's why we're leaving it in through all this, the pineapple and the pepper and everything, because we don't want it to be raw in the middle. We want to remember we made small chunks. We've got the sweet and sour. We've got the pineapple. We've got the peppers. We've got everything cooking. We've got everything going. We're stirring it constantly because we want to make it thickened. Voila. We have sweet and sour pork. Delicious. We want to serve it with some rice. I always say to put the rice on the side and let people take what they want. I like white rice. I think it's prettier and it's delicious and everybody likes it. You have whatever kind of rice you think your people would like. Yeah, people say they want brown rice because it has more, a nuttier flavor. You know, it's a very good point. And wild rice. Well, yeah, if it's a real preference. If you're going to do a more unusual rice, you might want to have white rice as an option also. Personally speaking, I think that these things, any kind of a starch should go on the side so that people can take as much as they want and as much as a stir fry on top of it as they want, much as a sweet and sour pork. And because this recipe, people are saying should put out a whole bunch of rice. I actually own a rice cooker. It's the only kind of a strange one-purpose utensil that I have just because it's so easy to do and I use a lot of rice. I come a lot with rice, and you can set up the rice cooker if you've got facilities at all because it cooks, it does it itself. You can set it up and have it going during the process while everybody's talking and like that, and then it's all fluffy and nice when you go to eat it and hot. Yes, and that's our adventure recipe. Uh-huh, because it has pork. But it's all done, right? It's all finished. These are two very easy recipes. And because it is a stir fry, if you have the facilities, and it smells marvelous, if you have the facilities, you can come with the raw ingredients. You know, you cut the pork into the cubes, you cut the pepper into the cubes. Nobody wants to watch you dice things. You know, you seed the pepper, you get it all ready. I actually come with little like Tupperware pots. You know what I mean? The little plastic pots with the lids. Everything's refrigerated, yeah. And I come with it all separate. And you can make it, if you've got a stove and a skillet, and it would add to the conviviality, you can make it with the group. All right, they're watching you. It's not really making it with the group. I'm not fond of handing people knives. But it's something to do, something to watch, something to network with, something to do together. And it smells really good. And it only takes a few minutes. What is it, a 10-minute top process, the whole thing? Because you do the pork and then you do the peppers and then you add the pineapple and the wet ingredients and it's all simmery and it's all done and it makes a lovely smell and you stir it around and you talk about it as you're doing it and then everybody gets some and it's a lovely group activity. I think this of all stir fries, if you possibly have the facilities to do it. Mm-hmm. But I don't want you to think that I think people should actually have to prep the food. You come with it all prepped so that you could just toss it in the skillet. You could just make it as you stand there. Yeah. Anyway, so it's a great group activity. So that is our adventure recipe. And I see that our time together is nearly up. Thank you very much for all of your participation. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. I always learn something on these shows, and I hope you do too. If you'd like to contact us, we're at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website is recipeforpeacenow.com. Prior shows, the last five, are archived on the website. The most recent ones, this one will show up almost as soon as we get finished. They're archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thank you for coming. Thank you for all of your participation. Thank you for listening. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.